the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
But I wonder, as I've been preparing, I've been thinking about three questions. Firstly, what has my past been like? Secondly, how am I doing today? And thirdly, what do I want my life to be like in the future? They're easy questions to say, but to be honest, as I'm sure you'll imagine, a little bit trickier to answer, especially when you've got 30 minutes. But as I reflected on the questions, thinking about the nature of the topics that we've been covering in this series in response to the questionnaire that went through Belmont last year about what is it that people find blocks them in their journey towards a closer relationship to God, the more I felt that there's probably something very important in those questions around the way we gain insight from God and wisdom from him to help us live our lives a bit better. The question, I guess, is really in answer to the fact that if we look back to our past, none of us were born putting ourselves first. Babies don't put themselves first. And we've all got points in our lives as we look back, I guess, isn't it, when we can sense that sometimes we are putting ourselves first and other times when we're not. But perhaps the most interesting and most challenging thing is, as we look forward, we all have a choice. We all have a big choice. Do I or don't I put myself, others, God first? And so I pray, as I've been preparing, that God will illuminate that choice for us this morning. Miss Jones had been giving her second year students at junior school a lesson on science. She'd explained all about magnets and showed them how they pick up nails and other bits of iron. And at the end of the lesson, as she usually did, it was question time. And she asked the class, "Children, my name begins with the letter M, and I pick things up. What am I?" Little Connor on the front row proudly put his hand up and said, "Miss, I know the answer. You're a mother." Do you know, I spent ages and ages at school convincing myself that I was going to be a great scientist, that I was good at science. But the truth is that I wasn't. I was actually pretty hopeless at it. And maybe Connor found that out to his cost at a point in life too. Equally, I wonder if you've been great at DIY. Men like to think that they can fix pretty much anything, don't they? I like to pretend that I can do it too. But a succession of half-hearted attempts and failures probably indicates to me that I'm no better at it now than I was when I first picked up a tool set. There are many here who will testify to that when they've been on the end of a 999 help call, Phil Taylor. But I'm deluding myself when I think I am great at DIY. But by the same token, in the same way as I deluded myself that I was once going to be a great scientist and that I would be good at DIY, I'd like to stand here now and say to you, in all honesty, that my past has been perfect. I'd like to stand here and say that it's been years since I detected a flaw in my personality or my character, and that I can't see me needing ever to change a thing in my life in the future. In short, that I'm a good Christian, living life as God intended it to be. And yet, if I look back and I'm honest, and I look at myself here today, as I've shared here and elsewhere, I and others unfortunately know the pain of my failures in things like calling the right balance and the right priorities in my life, where I do things wrong on a constant and repetitive basis, where I spend money on the wrong things, make the wrong friendship calls, I'm in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong motive, of shock at my ability to project my problems and issues onto the lives of others, and so on. And you know, I would pretty much, despite all that, throughout my whole life have said that I was a good man and a good Christian. These past 6 months, I've been through what I can honestly say is the most fundamental change of my understanding of and relationship with God. The reason? God, through others and through reading and listening to his words, finally has been able to get through to me that how I'm doing today and what I'll be like in the future is actually, in very simple terms, about whether I choose to stop comforting myself that I'm a good person and a good Christian, but to be honest about on whose terms I make that judgment. For years and years, I've allowed the behaviours and standards and activities of others who don't walk a close walk with God and their feedback to me based on their self-perspective and interest to be the dominant measure of how I view my life, of how good I feel about myself. And that all began to change when I finally allowed the words of a challenge from two people separately to take root in my life. Those words, "Do you love Jesus?" I confess, when I was asked the question the first time, let alone the second time, it was a jolt. In fact, if I'm honest, I thought it was a bit of an insult and a bit of a cheek. Do you love Jesus? That was until I stopped and looked at myself and was honest, just like I had to be about my ability at science and DIY, and saw that there were loads and loads and loads of actions and words that pointed to the fact that although I believed in and loved Jesus, I was making priority calls which showed that I loved myself more. I wouldn't have said it in these terms. I might have said that I loved football. I loved going out. I loved being in with the in crowd. I loved being seen in the right places, or even being seen at Belmont and doing good works. But the truth is, I had a tendency to be doing things that were really about me, doing what I thought was right and best for me, and not necessarily about putting God first. So I stand here today, to be honest, not having sorted it out, being far from perfect, not to judge, but to try and help us see that there is a real and present danger, and also that we have a choice, each of us, for our own todays and our futures. That choice is yours whether you've been a Christian for years or days, or are just in church this morning for other reasons. In the end, church is a community of people, a place where God moves and speaks and wants to change lives. I'm believing that he will do that regardless of who you are this morning, because he loves you more than you know. I'm believing that most, if not all of us, set out to live life with the best of intentions, but that other influences or distractions can get in the way and see us lapse into habits where it may be, for example, only a crisis causes us to question whether or not we're building our lives on the most important of foundations. Let's turn to our passage, John chapter 5, verse 30. I'm actually going to read to the end of the chapter because there's some helpful verses a bit further on. John chapter 5, verse 30. "But myself, by myself, I can do nothing. I judge only as I hear, and my judgment is just, for I seek not to please myself, but him who sent me. If I testify about myself, my testimony is not true. There is another who testifies in my favor, and I know that his testimony about me is true. You have sent to John, and he has testified to the truth. Not that I accept human testimony, but I mention it that you may be saved. John was a lamp that burned and gave light, and you chose for a time to enjoy his light. I have testimony weightier than that of John. For the works that the Father has given me to finish, the very works that I am doing, testify that the Father has sent me. And the Father who sent me has himself testified concerning me. You have never heard his voice, nor seen his form, nor does his word dwell in you. For you do not believe the one he sent. You study the scriptures diligently because you think that in them you possess eternal life. These are the very scriptures that testify about me, yet you refuse to come to me to have life. I do not accept glory from human beings, but I know you. I know that you do not have the love of God in your hearts. I have come in my Father's name and you do not accept me. But if someone else comes in his own name, you will accept him. How can you believe since you accept glory from one another, but do not seek the glory that comes from the only God? But do not think I will accuse you before the Father. Your accuser is Moses, on whom your hopes are set. If you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. But since you do not believe what I wrote, how are you going to believe what I say?" To understand what Jesus is saying here as he spoke to the Jewish people, have a quick look back at verse 18. This is why the Jews were seeking to kill him, not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. He was speaking against some of the rules and regulations and traditions that the Jewish people had been told were right and against which they should live their life. Because it suited the Jews to keep harking back to the rules they tried to impose on people's lives. That way they could keep themselves in control, in power, in a position of self-importance, and keep the new living word of Jesus in check. It was a way of keeping up appearances, if you like, the appearance of God being important when so often it was their own importance that they were trying to feed and protect. In short, they kept putting themselves before God. Their inflated view of who they were, of their own importance, their ability to determine their own type of history, of the opportunities this would present to make themselves important by their own rules, and also look around the world in which we live and ask yourself the question now, isn't that the same as so much of what we are a victim of today? Time and again, there's a disconnect between what we say and what we do. No wonder we at times feel empty, unfulfilled, and out of control. So too does the car driver who spends an inordinate amount of time polishing and cleaning the car, showing it off to his friends, and then forgets to put any petrol in it to make it go anywhere. That disconnect between what we say and what we do is the same thing as the so-called apparently perfect family who are challenged by the author Caitlin Flanagan in Time magazine recently. She said, "We all want this deep, meaningful time together in the haven of our homes, but when people actually get home, everybody races off. Mum's got something on the DVD, the daughter's on YouTube or Facebook, the son's got his video game, dad's checking the sports news and his work emails, and everyone's compartmentalised within the household, a disconnect between what we say and what we do. So too am I creating that disconnect when I tell Karen I love her and buy her presents and ensure that I'm the great provider, but I'm not giving her real quality time, preferencing her over my work, my emails, my boys' toys, my other distractions and excuses. That's a form of love, but it's not real love. It's this status quo of love but not real love that I think we lapse into, that Jesus is challenging the Jews and us about here. He's throwing down the gauntlet before us all, saying, you want a life with real meaning? Then make me your focus, not your wife, your husband, your children, your grandkids, your job, your playtime. They'll let you down. Make me your focus, and I bring all those other areas into order. Love me over all others. The problem, though, I put it to you, is that we, in perhaps our overly rich society, with our overly lazy ways, so often want it both ways. To help us see this in the context of a real life today, let me introduce you to Dave Hopton, who's one of our students here at Belmont, who's going to share his story with us now.
Good morning, everyone. My name's Dave. I'm a second year politics student at the university. And my particular passion within politics is American politics. I love it. Frankly, I could talk all morning about it. And basically, when I was applying to Exeter, it was one of the key reasons I chose to come here. I knew full well that I could have the option of studying abroad. So I chose Exeter on that basis that I intended to spend a year in the States. So first year went fine, really great. I was still enjoying the course, still up for it. Second year came, I went to all the meetings, read all the literature, knew that it was still what I wanted to do and what I believe God wanted me to do. So therefore, I applied on the 1st of February this year. My top three university choices were all very competitive, with extremely limited places, but I knew that that was where I wanted to go, and I was pretty confident that because God wanted me there, he'd sort it all out, and that's where I'd end up. So anyway, I applied on the 1st of February. Study abroad office takes a week to decide, so I knew that by February the 8th I'd have an answer. And that week absolutely flew by. I was very, very excited, but it felt very much like a formality. I was convinced that that was where I was going to go. I was just kind of wanting to find out which uni out of the three God was going to send me to. And then I got an email on that Tuesday saying, unfortunately, I hadn't got any of my choices. It listed a few universities that still had places that I could apply to, perhaps apply by midday on Friday that week, but none of them stood out at all to me. To say that I was gutted would be a pretty great understatement. I'd been building up to this since I'd applied to Exeter at A-level. Psychologically, I prepared myself to sort of be saying goodbye to friends and not then graduate with them. I didn't have a house for next year, let alone anyone to live with. I hadn't applied to any internships that summer because American terms start far earlier, so it wouldn't have worked out practically. Basically, things just were not great. I wasn't really in a good position for the next academic year. But the worst part of all was the fact that it seemed pretty evident that I'd completely misunderstood God. I'd been 100% convinced that he'd wanted me to go, that he placed America on my heart. but here it seemed was the door being fairly emphatically shut in my face. To put this in context, this was all happening during the ECU events week, so it was with a very weary heart that I went to Boston's that evening. At quite a few points as I was walking there, I wanted to just sit down and stop, but anyway, I got there. And God was already working, and that evening I ended up sitting next to a friend who's an American, who's over here studying for a term, and he knew I'd applied, so he asked me how I'd gotten on, and I had to tell him. It wasn't easy, but I had to tell him. He asked, I guess out of curiosity, where the other places were that I'd been offered. So I rattled the list off. And when I mentioned the University of Kansas, he sort of perked up. He knew quite a bit about it. It's a really big school with a big sports reputation. And he vaguely knew a few people who'd gone there. And he was able to tell me a little bit about it. And it sounded interesting, but I was still absolutely convinced that this was a clear sign from God that I wasn't meant to go. If I was going to go, then I would have got one of my first choices. So anyway, I got home that night. And I guess curiosity took the better of me. And I started looking at the website on Kansas. And it did look quite interesting, actually. I'm a big basketball nut, and they have an amazing basketball program. And there's lots of stuff going on. It's really cool. But basically, I looked at the course, and there was nothing there that interested me. And it's a heck of a lot of money to go and pay to sort of sleep through lectures. which I already do know. So anyway, that brings me to Wednesday morning. And I'd resolved that I was going to go and speak to the study abroad coordinator and say, you know, thanks for letting me apply, but to sort of try and graciously turn down the open offers. So I went up with him, and he was really nice. He said, I'm really sorry, there just weren't enough places. But he urged me to check out Kansas. And I told him I couldn't find any interesting modules. He told me that instead of looking on the department website, I should look on the overall university website, because they actually have like a full listing of all the modules. So I went home, and lo and behold, I found this full course catalogue, as they call it. And there were literally pages of modules that I hadn't seen before. Quite a few that were really similar to ones I'd hoped to study at my first choice unis. So I was beginning to get a little excited. So you can imagine how I reacted when I saw that for the entire second term of each academic year, the department selects a group of students to go and live in Washington, D.C. They help you secure a full-time internship to work in government. And you live out there, you study out there, you get credits for it. My first choice uni had been in Washington, because for politics you can't really go anywhere better. So to find out that they offered this wasn't just great, it was something better than I could have done. And I started to get a little bit excited about this. And just after I'd seen the study abroad coordinator that morning, I emailed Paul to request for some prayer, really, about what I should do and to get some advice. And his immediate response began to correlate with what a lot of my friends and especially my life group had said. They said that the fact that there were still offers on the table for American universities perhaps wasn't a sign that I wasn't meant to go to America, just to the universities that I'd chosen. And Paul wrote in his email that as long as things could practically work out and would make sense, then there wasn't really much sense in staying in Exeter and having to go through all the turmoil when perhaps God was leading me to America, and if things would fit together. And here, I think, were things starting to fit together. Even though Washington sounded incredible, though, I wasn't really sure that I'd even be eligible. So I went to the study abroad coordinator to ask if he could find out. He unfortunately didn't know, and he passed me on to a lady at the international office. And it happened that she was in meetings all day, and I only got through to her right at the end. And she said she'd email them to try and find out. And she arranged with me that we'd meet at 10:30 the next morning. So this was Friday, had to let them know by midday. And we'd arranged to meet at 10:30, and she'd hopefully be able to give me an answer. So I spent a lot of time praying that night, and I'd kind of got to the position that if she said that I was eligible, I was going to take it as a sign that God wanted me to go and apply in faith, but if I wasn't eligible, then I'd leave it. So anyway, I met up with her at 10:30, we talked, and she said that she hadn't heard a reply back from Kansas, which was about the worst outcome that could have been, because it didn't really help me decide either way. We talked things over, but basically, I was still in a pickle. I didn't really know. And it felt like I'd hit a brick wall. I was kind of, you know, I felt very close to God during that week, and I thought surely he was going to give me an answer. And after all I'd done, the way I'd applied in my own strength, I didn't want to go just because I wanted to go. I wanted to go because God wanted me to go. So I sat down after I'd talked at about 20 past 11 in the lobby of the International Building. And it's quite an amusing detail now, but it wasn't at the time. That week I actually was changing my phone. And it hadn't been activated yet, so I didn't have any signal. I couldn't call my parents or anyone for advice, so I felt very isolated, really. And so I decided really just to open the Bible app up on my phone, and I guess I was just looking for guidance, hope God would provide me with an answer. Anyway, I quite like to read through the Psalms, and I just felt the number 139 pop into my head, really random. Didn't actually know what Psalm 139 was, but then I turned to it and I recognised it. And I'm sure, as many of you will know, Psalm 139 begins by talking about how God has searched us and knows our hearts and desires intimately. And immediately I was like, whoa, this isn't just a random verse, this is quite relevant. I'd been sure that God wanted me to go to America, and yet all this had happened. So I carried on reading. Verses 5 and 6, "You hem me in behind and before. You have laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain." Okay, God, well, it's certainly true that you've hemmed me in. You've taken my choices away. I'm feeling pretty isolated here. Verse 7, "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I settle on the far side of the sea, there your hand will guide me." I was looking for an answer, and in Psalm 139, verse 9, I found it. I went to the study abroad coordinator at 11:45, found out that the five of the students who hadn't got places had all chosen other universities, and basically accepted an offer to study abroad for a year at the University of Kansas. So having had some time to think about all that week, a few significant themes have really emerged. Firstly, I still believe that God always wanted me to go to America, but when I look back at it, it's clear that at every stage I was trying to decide how and where. I didn't even look at Kansas because it wasn't somewhere that initially appealed to me. I overlooked it for bigger and better institutions. But actually, Kansas ticks so many boxes and gives me far better opportunities than I could have ever got at some of my first choices. Secondly, I thought the year was going to be all about me, how I could learn more about American politics, how I would be that cool British guy with the awesome accent, how I would have an amazing year immersing myself in American college life. But nothing really about how I could serve and glorify God. Sure, I was looking forward to witnessing to non-Christians, having conversations about Jesus, all the usual Christian stuff. But that part of the plan was very much on the back burner. It wasn't the sole focus. And it took a chaotic and frankly stressful week for me to be reminded of who I'm meant to be living for, who I'm actually supposed to be trusting in, and who my whole life is meant to exalt and point to. I still don't know all the details about Kansas. I don't know whether I'm eligible to apply for Washington. I still don't know how quite I'm going to get all the money that I need. But I do know that my sole focus for the whole year and in everything to do with it has to be about God. I recently started reading a book by John Piper, and I think he summarizes this far better than I ever could. God created me and you to live with a single, all-embracing, all-transforming passion, namely, a passion to glorify God by enjoying and displaying his supreme excellence in all the spheres of life. Thanks.
Thank you, Dave, so much. So I keep putting myself before God. So let's look at the passage for a few pointers about the symptoms and the solutions to this ever-present issue. And we'll use some key phrases from within the passage to help us. The first one is Jesus said in verse 30, "By myself I can do nothing." And my thanks here go to one of the house groups who very kindly sent me some notes from their own discussions this week, where they pointed out graphically that if that statement was true for Jesus, "By myself I can do nothing," then how much more so must it be true for us? The difference, of course, is that Jesus admitted it and then lived his life putting God first so that he could actually be truly useful and therefore be a true someone. And yet all too often, I guess, we're thinking and acting as though we are someone in our own right. If we seek for others to rub shoulders with us or us with them, we aren't necessarily seeking that we and they rub shoulders with God. Matthew 6, verse 21 says that what we choose to make of worth like treasure in our lives will show where our heart really is. If I treasure things or people other than God, then my heart will surely go there too. Secondly, Jesus also says, "There is another who testifies in my favor, and I know that his testimony about me is true." But I wonder what the testimony of others says about me or about you. Does it speak about what you do or who you are? Does it speak about you being a mirror back to how good you yourself are? or that you're a clear window through which others better see the glory of God. Thirdly, we read, "For I seek not to please myself, but him who sent me." I wonder what you seek for yourself. To what or who do you seek to give pleasure? Have you truly asked yourself the question why you were born? Or to what purpose you're putting your time on this planet? Is it ultimately to please yourself or other things which are temporary, or for the glory of God? Maybe Dave challenged you on that right now. Fourthly, we read, "I mention it," Jesus says, "that you may be saved," in verse 34. Pretty big mention. Looking to real claims of Jesus is that important that it can save us. Save us from ourselves. Save us from living ultimately a futile life. It will enhance our life on this earth beyond measure. But it will also save us from a life here and a life after the one we have here, where we miss out on the very best of times and things. In the end, people and ourselves, as we all know, will be a letdown. Jesus never has been or will be a letdown. And we also read, "Yet you refuse to come to me," to Jesus, "to have life," in verse 40. The people here who Jesus was talking to, and it's the same, let's be honest, for us here today, have the word of God, the spoken words of others, and the lives of others lived out for God, and the presence of Jesus right here as evidence that Jesus is who he says he is, the Son of God, come to give purpose to the world. Because of that, here we see that despite the best attempts of the Jews, it isn't Jesus who ultimately is on trial. He ultimately is there and our judge. Verse 30. It's the people watching, listening, and then ignoring him who are actually the ones who are on trial. This is the same reality of our world today, and maybe even us as we sit here right now. We try to put Jesus on trial to prove that we are right and he isn't, that we can do it our way, not his. Yet the evidence of Jesus and his love for us is all around us. He came to show us a better love. He died for us to show us real love. He rose again to make that love and forgiveness available to us here and now. The question for us then is that the story of Jesus has been told and is being lived out, but the jury on us is out. The jury on Jesus is an out, but the jury on you sits. What will we do with Jesus? When the truly just end judgment on each of our lives comes, will we be among those who are weighed by the court and found wanting? As C.S. Lewis said in his book, Mere Christianity, you must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. Those claiming to have chosen that last mentioned option to call him Lord and God must though face the challenge. What difference is all of this making in my life? Or as verse 44 challenges us, where are we putting the balance of our effort? In seeking to obtain praise from others or praise from God? And yet we all, each one of us here today, not least of all me, are in no position to judge. Let's not forget that we all sin. We all struggle with a culture that makes this even harder. A society and a culture where we are as self-sufficient as we want to be, and that's encouraged to be good. A culture that says if you're promoted above others, that's a great reward. A culture that says so long as others think you're a great bloke or a lady that's really popular, then that's a really great accolade. A culture that says it's good to be proud of your achievements, to boast about your children's performance, to cherish and to seek approval because of through them, others and your achievements. That's good. I put it to you that ultimately God might say that's selfish and it's very me-centered. And the culture we live in is very me-centered. But the cause of that is that in the end, we end up looking out for ourselves. Jesus came to this earth because of the sin of all people. He says in verse 46, If you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. Moses wrote about Christ. He wrote because the people of our planet need a saviour. And over the past few weeks, maybe by coincidence, probably not, I've been reading about the people of Israel, who Moses led. How much it struck me in that reading, and I've been challenged, that just like the children of Israel, my little burnt offerings, the tokens of myself I offer to God from time to time, often when it suits me, are actually of very little, if not no interest to God, until I've first shown and lived out how much the great sin offering he made himself for me on Calvary really matters to me, really affects my life day by day. Until it really matters, it really drives what I do and say I am. It's as empty as me saying that I love Karen, buy her flowers alongside those words, and then I live my life as if it didn't matter at all. Similarly, what a tragedy it is that some people, Christian or not, today should prefer to settle for something less than God's best. What about you? Are you like the Israelites, content to remain on this side of the Jordan and miss the promised land by not putting God first in your life? Are you settling for less than God's best? Have you, like me for so long, and even now, begun to kick out those things, those people maybe, those traditions and those self-delusions that move God down your list of priorities, down your list of reasons for living, and which prevent you from getting all of God's promise for yourself and for others? Is there room in your heart for God to change you? Is there room in your life, in Belmont, for people who've really blown it? Of course there is. If not, what are we doing here? Or have we, you, I, allowed our perspectives to change because we've subtly put ourselves in the place of God? The church is a place for people destroyed by sin. The church is a place for God's wounded. The church is a place where those who are broken come and are made whole again. And here is the good news. In Jesus Christ, we are forgiven. A note came out from the Evangelical Alliance this week, their council meeting, and it said, if the church is not on the streets for the free Egypt, it will not be part of the new Egypt. Will you be on the streets this week for God and God alone? Will you be on the streets, so to speak, of your workplace, of your home, for God and God alone this week? Will you live only to be a window to God for others, showing through your deprioritization of yourself that without God, life is ultimately meaningless? James chapter 4, verse 10 calls us to humble ourselves before the Lord, and he will lift you up. It's elsewhere said that humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. I sense God calling us and saying that it is time for us to all be humble and admit that too often we do put ourselves first in the past and in the present. The good thing, however, is that God doesn't sit here to beat us up about it, but to offer us a better future. However, this is our choice. It's your choice. You can't be double-minded and seek approval from the world and approval from God. Do you choose yourself or do you choose God? If you choose God, it's a calling to put yourself, your ego, your pride, your own agenda to one side. Romans 12 says that our response to God's mercy should be to offer our bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God, not to conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but to be transformed. At the end of the day, you've got to have actors to go on that stage. It's a bit like creating a theatre. The actors are the athletes, and that's why it's so important they are properly supported. The judgment about the success of the games is not going to be about the buildings and ceremonies. It will be about the ability to win medals and create those amazing moments that inspire the next generation of heroes. So spoke the chief executive of the British Olympic Association, Andy Hunt, this week, after it was announced that they didn't have enough money to fund the British team at the 2012 Olympics. But I'd say Andy Hunt's got it wrong. The Olympic Games will come and go. Money will come and go. Your life will come and go. Today will come and go. The judgment of your, my, our life isn't going to be about buildings, ceremonies, life medals and trophies. It's going to be about the amazing moments each and every day where we get rid of the mirror and become a window to God. Where I put God before myself. Where I or we fight back against the culture that says our value is only in the medals we award ourselves, in our identity as others see us using their own flawed value set, and that this is what gives us significance. Life, I assure you, is not best lived if it's shaped by the culture of me, which pervades so much of today. When the music of your life fades, what will the final song be? Will it be Frank Sinatra's "I Did It My Way"? Or will it be, as will happen here tomorrow, I am sure, at Ron Baker's funeral, something that reflects a life lived quietly pointing to the God who brought us onto this planet, who wants us to live our best for him, and to whom ultimately we will return if we live to serve him. As the song says, "Shine your light and let the whole world see," we're singing or living for the glory of the risen King. What would others testify that your life is about if all the veneer was stripped away today? Would it be for the glory of the risen King? So, do you love Jesus? My own journey tells me that there's a little bit of a flaw in asking this question, as it isn't one to be asked in the absolute sense. The answer for millions of people across the globe and hundreds here this morning to that question can be very simple and easy. Yes, I love Jesus and what he stands for. But for many, that's added to because they love him for what he has done for them. However, that response can be largely, if we're honest, I guess, intellectual. Maybe a bit built on our own history, not affecting the priority calls and sacrifices of our day-to-day life. The most important question, I put it to you, is do you really love Jesus? A question to be asked in the absolute and the relative sense. Firstly, have you and are you giving him a chance? Have you ever really thought what loving Jesus can do for you? But in many ways, and more importantly, how do you demonstrate that that's real to you? You really love Jesus when he is your only reason for living. When every minute and every pound is spent only seeking to point others through you as a window to him. Not spent making sure that you have the best mirror, pointing to the best temporary things in the business of your own life. Or I wonder, are we, in our choices, showing that our love of God is actually one that slights and undervalues Christ because we admire and overvalue ourselves? So we didn't put ourselves first on the day we were born. We have, though, acquired a habit as we live life where, to a greater or lesser extent, we keep putting ourselves before God now. But we do have a chance to live a better future. What can we do? Alex Ferguson, the manager of Manchester United, is famous for saying that if his team isn't winning, there must be more time yet to be played. Do you know why he does that? It's because he always tells his players, if they lose a match, that they didn't lose it, but they just ran out of time. We, though, never run out of time while we're on this earth. But our opportunity to make our lives count does diminish each and every day. We allow our old habits to continue to prevail. I wonder if God's speaking to you right now that it's time to make a change, to not run out of time to experience life in all its fullness. Maybe for the first time, God's saying to you, are you going to take me seriously? Are you going to put me first and live life here and now the way I intended it to be? Maybe you accept and acknowledge that your standards have slipped, that you've put yourself first too often. Maybe in big things or little things. Or maybe it's just a new time for you, a fresh understanding that we are only here in the fleeting moments of our life to bring glory to God. That putting ourselves first is a decision that ultimately puts God behind us. I'd like to invite you before we sing, before we close, just to close your eyes. And if God's speaking to you now about the problem we all have, let's be honest, of putting ourselves first, maybe now's the time to reach out to him. Maybe now's the time to apologise. Maybe now's the time to name one or more things which you're going to let go of as you seek to put God before yourself.